And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. You know, a gentleman I've had on a number of times here because he's a very interesting guest. He just knows so much about, well, so many areas, is Michael Collins Piper. And he puts out a book, three or four books a year, and they're all good books. So he's just a prolific author. And so it's easy to have him on. I can talk about his newest book. So he's got a new book out now. It's called Ye Shall Know the Truth. Ye shall know the truth. That's sort of interesting that he's sort of uses a few Bible verses for titles of books. Well, I don't know of any title of a book better than this. Ye shall know the truth, because Jesus Christ said that himself. And Jesus went on, the truth shall make you free. Well, Michael Collins Piper sent me his newest book and I read it and wow. I really do think if you followed his advice, if you're not set free, you probably would be, okay? Now, I know Jesus is the only way. I'm talking about it would awaken you in this world. Now, let me give you the subtitle, but actually the book is much more than the subtitle. It says, you shall know the truth, and then below it, the letters say, 101 books American nationalist need to read and understand before they burn them. And I had to, you know, sort of laugh a little bit about this because it's absolutely true. If you're an American nationalist, if you love our Constitution, our country, our heritage, then there's at least 101 books. I think he actually covers a lot more than that in this book. You start with 101 books, and by then, I think you're going to already know the truth. You're probably going to be so angry. I don't know what you're going to do. But you need to read and understand these books before they, and he's got that in quotation marks, burn them. Well, I found that sort of interesting. We're going to ask Michael Collins Piper about that because he's right here on the phone with me. Michael, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be aboard with you, Tex. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, you're with the American Free Press, but you're sort of an independent author, too. And I see every week I get an issue of American Free Press, and I look in there, I see very interesting articles you've written about various things. You really keep up. But then periodically you send me a great book that you have. Let me just right away say that you're no doubt the premier author exposing Zionism in America.
No dispute about that. I really appreciate that comment, period, but I also appreciate it in particular coming from you. That's quite a lot to say, and I appreciate it, Tex.
Well, it is true, and so, you know, I've read these books. There's other good writers, too. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, but they'll write one or two books or whatever, but you just keep, boy, I mean, we're going to talk about several, if that's okay with you, but you say here, and this is really for American nationalists. Why do you say, here's things you should know, and you're addressing this book to American nationalists?
Well, you know, it's funny, Tex, as we were sitting here, and I was hearing you reading out the subtitle, 101 Books American Nationalists Need to Read and Understand Before They Burn Them, it occurred to me that, in fact, this book is for more than just American nationalists. It's for anyone who, from the United States or from anywhere around the world, who wants to know what has been going on, particularly in America, but with American foreign policy and the impact it's had on the course of global affairs. And you know, one thing I always hasten to point out, you know, right in the opening pages of the book, I said that there's probably a lot of people who won't be interested in the book because it's a book about books. And but this book is more than a book about books.
Oh,
and it's
absolutely.
It's not just a book about the books that we've all heard about. You know, one person told me, they said, I'm going to read your book, but I already have all the key books that patriots have put out. And I say, wait a minute, that's precisely the problem. I said, I have them all too. But I said, in my library, I have about 10,000 books, and about 9,500 of them aren't by patriots. They're just by other writers. And that's the point of this book. I'm trying to introduce patriots, nationalists, people who have the concerns about what's going on in our world today. I'm trying to introduce them to a wide variety of other books that have been put out there, even by mainstream publishing houses, by sometimes very well-known authors, Pulitzer Prize winners, other people, celebrity authors, these books that contain valuable information buried within their pages. And that's one thing over the years as a writer for American Free Press and for the Spotlight before it, I used to have people call me and say, well, I don't read anything but American Free Press, or I only read books published by American Free Press, or something like that. You know, and I'd say, well, that's great. I mean, we appreciate your support, but I always rush to tell people that they shouldn't ignore what the mass media is saying. Number one, because you can get an idea what the New World Order forces have in mind for us, you know, by monitoring the New York Times and the Washington Post, or, you know, the Dallas Morning News or the Los Angeles Times or whatever.
That's a good
point.
But
number two, there are also a lot of books that have been put out by big mainstream publishing houses that have a lot of revealing information in them.
Mm-hmm.
And those books shouldn't be discounted. So although in the pages of this book, I mention, for example, your book, Conspiracy of the Six-Pointed Star, and I mentioned Phil Turney's book on the USS Liberty and, you know, what I saw that day. I mentioned the works of Victor Thorne, particularly his series on Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, and these are books that a lot of patriots are familiar with. People that listen to your program are familiar with the works of Victor Thorne. But what I focus on here is all these other books covering a wide variety of areas that have valuable information in it that people can then use in their own research, or that, you know, if they want to make a point to a friend who said, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I don't, you know, you have good books, Mike Piper, but, you know, I mean, you're known as an extremist. And I say, well, hold on, wait a minute. Here's a mainstream book by a very well-known author that has some really good information in that can prove your point. And that's the whole point of this book. I'm trying to point people in the direction of the material that I'm familiar with. Most of these books I actually have in my own library, or if they're not in my library, I have read them, and then in a handful of cases, I haven't actually read them, but I'm familiar with the material that's in them and who the authors are. And that's why I'm saying to people, there's a world of available material out there that you can add to your own library that will really help you get a better understanding of things. And so like I say, to bring it full circle here, this book is not just a list of 101 books, and it's not just a list of books that American nationalists need to read. It's a book for anyone who wants some good leads in literature in a wide variety of areas, whether it's from big government and government power to Israel and the Middle East, or specifically on what I refer to as the Jewish problem, as aside from the Israeli connection, the Israeli interest, U.S. foreign policy, American nationalism versus internationalism, books about the media, books about the Federal Reserve and the big money interests, you know, covering a wide variety of areas. So that's what the book is about.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting to me. I remember two guys were on TV some years ago. One was General Zini. Marine Corps, I can't remember whether he was a commandant. But he was, you know, probably one of the top two or three Marine officers. And then he co-wrote a book with Clancy, the guy that wrote all these best-selling books.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it really blasted the neocons, the neoconservatives. But they never mentioned the word Jew or Jewish or Israel in the book. But, you know, they were really severely criticized, and they were on, I think it was the O'Reilly show on the Fox, and they were asked, well, isn't this an anti-Semitic book? You know, and they said, well, we've never even talked about the Jews, or Israel. So they used this, coin this phrase word that everybody knows. When you mention neocon, well, everybody knows that you're talking about the Jews. And so they did mention that. I guess they thought they could escape being called, like you are, an extremist, because you go ahead and just tell everybody.
Yeah.
You know, why leave them guessing? But I saw that the guy that's very famous with the New York Times, the Bernstein character, you know, Woodward and Bernstein.
Actually, he was the Washington Post.
Washington Post.
Yeah, the Washington Post. Yeah. The guy who was one of the pioneers of the Watergate coverage, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he came out and, you know, basically said, you know, the neocons got us into that horrible war with George W. Bush in Iraq, and it was a terrible war, et cetera. Of course, he's sort of late in saying that, isn't he? I mean, he's waited till, you know.
You know, it's really funny you bring that up, Tex, because I just mentioned that story about Bernstein the other day, and Bernstein actually went on to say that it was a bunch of Jewish neoconservatives, and then he paused and he said something along the lines of, well, I guess I can say that because I'm Jewish.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I told a friend of mine about this. I have this one friend who really is good at parroting what the mainstream media says. He's someone who absolutely does live and breathe by what appears in the mainstream media. And every time I've ever said, well, that this was really a Jewish war in Iraq for Jewish interests, he would always start naming. He'd say, well, George Bush wasn't Jewish. Condoleezza Rice wasn't Jewish. Colin Powell wasn't Jewish. Dick Cheney wasn't Jewish. You know, this mantra, you know. But in fact, and I'd say to him, well, what about all the people who orchestrated it, you know? Well, here was Bernstein himself saying precisely what I had said. And I told my friend about this, and he paused and he said, really?
Yeah.
And I said, yes. Yeah. And, you know, see, that's a perfect example because, see, here's Bernstein, who's very much a part of the mainstream media. And we see this all the time in the mainstream media. There are big names, big people, even like Tom Clancy joining General Zini writing this book, you know, that they actually do say some very important things in their books,
mm-hmm.
and in their writings. And that's why we shouldn't just arbitrarily dismiss them, you know what I mean? Because that's what I say. I mean, you know, like I say, in my personal library, I've never, you know, obviously after you have a certain number of books, it's like, you know, someday I could maybe sit down and count all my books, but it's roughly about 10,000, not more than 10,000, but, you know, and maybe not quite 10,000, but I have a lot of books, needless to say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I say, I've found more often than not that in all of those books, you can find something of relevance, you know, and you may not ever have occasion to use it for years and years and years, but you know, this is what happened to me when I wrote my first book, the one on the Kennedy assassination, Final Judgment. When I first sat down to write that book, I had a thought. It was a thought in my mind about the thesis. And then I started going to my own personal library and with a little sheet of paper with about 5 or 10 names and concepts written down on this sheet of paper. Actually, it was an old piece of cardboard that I had actually ripped out of the back of an old photo album because I didn't have any writing paper handy. And so I'd scribbled all this stuff down. And so I started going into my own personal library and pulling books off the shelf. And some of these books, I only found one or two lines,
mm-hmm.
that were of relevance.
Right.
But those one or two lines put me in the direction of research that led me to 5 or 10 other books in those particular subject areas.
Ah.
And see, that's what I've found over the years, that, you know, there's so much out there, so much valuable material out there. And I think you can attest to this, too, because, you know, when you're scanning the newspapers and the magazines, you'll find some of the most amazing facts buried.
Oh, yes.
In those stories. And, you know, I think I've actually told this story in an interview with you before on the air here, that oftentimes I've actually come, when I read the Washington Post, if I see there's a major news story developing, I see the headline, obviously, which attracts me to the story. Many, 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 many times what I will do is I will actually read the closing paragraphs of the story first.
Hmm.
Then read the middle paragraphs of the story, then read the story from beginning to end, because a lot of times you will find the most important points or the points that you kind of get the idea that they want to mention it for the record, but then they want to bury it.
That's true.
We'll find it. And I give you a perfect example of this. Years ago, there was an airplane incident off the coast of Manhattan. A plane had taken off from one of the airports up there, and it crashed. And, you know, hundreds of people died. No one survived. And there were questions about who was responsible, and there was all sorts of finger-pointing and all sorts of theories and so forth. But I remember the day that I was reading the Washington Post account of that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what really led me in this direction of thinking this way about reading articles like this, and more often than not, it's proven to be a good way to do it. But in that particular Washington Post article, the final paragraph, and if it wasn't the final paragraph, it was the next to final paragraph, but you get my point. It was like the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It says, and by the way, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, and by the way, there were 200 or 300 high-ranking Egyptian and military intelligence officials aboard the airplane.
Oh,
all
boy.
Of them were lost with the other passengers.
Wow, isn't that something?
Now, you know, and I'm saying to myself,
You know,
and that fact was buried in the final paragraph or paragraphs, but I'm sure it was the final paragraph,
mm-hmm.
of the major newspaper in America, even possibly to the exclusion of the New York Times. Right there in the Washington Post. And same thing. I will see some. Remember, we had Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 19th or 20th hijacker. I forget what the official figure is of the 9/11 hijackers, if indeed there were hijackers. Who knows? But there was this guy, Zacharias Moussaoui. And, of course, he's the one who was not on the plane. He was up in Minnesota, blah, 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 blah. In the gossip section, which is essentially what it is, in the style section of the Washington Post, right before his trial to begin, was this big, long article talking about him and kind of casting him as kind of both a dangerous figure, but as also a comic figure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, buried in the midst of that story was the revelation that Moussaoui had said at one point, well, if I was involved in this conspiracy... which I deny, the FBI knew exactly what I was doing because the FBI was following me for a whole year prior to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is in the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's buried in plain sight. And that's what a lot of the books that I talk about here, some of the books are books that you would never expect to find major revelations in, but there they are.
There they are.
These pages. And I've tied it together thematically. You know, like I have a whole chapter on the Watergate scandal,
mm-hmm.
and showing how there's a lot of material out there about Watergate. And I have the whole truth about organized crime and frankly, about the Jewish contingent that's predominant in organized crime. You know, things like this. And these books that I'm largely quoting are main, quote-unquote mainstream books from mainstream publishers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it's easy to point at somebody like Mike Piper and say, oh, Mike Piper, he works for that American extremist publication, American Free Press, you know.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. But it's pretty hard to take point your finger in the same direction. Like I refer a number of times to the works of a guy by the name of Roger Morris,
mm-hmm.
who's written some very important books about a number of subjects. And one of his books is A History of Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And he's a former member of the National Security Council, former official of the National Security Council. And his book on the history of Las Vegas not only makes it clear, just a couple points here, this goes to show you. Number one, he makes clear that basically organized crime in Las Vegas was primarily a Jewish operation. Number two, that some other revelations he points out that the Mormon Church and big banks connected to the Mormon Church helped bankroll the rise of Las Vegas as a gambling mecca, which would come as a surprise to a lot of people. Number three, he points out that these characters who were running organized crime in Las Vegas were tied tightly for a long, long time with not just organized crime in Las Vegas, of course, but all over the United States, and tied directly to Israel and its operations internationally.
Mm.
So you get all the, and then he gets into the area of how the organized crime out of Las Vegas played a major part in bringing to power people like Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And other major politicians, both Democrat and Republican, liberal and conservative alike. So here's a book published by the mainstream that has all this explosive material in.
Yeah.
You know, and it can be found out there. It can be found if you know where to look, and that's kind of what my book is. It's kind of a guidebook, and it's like, as I put it in the book, I say, okay, I've told you what I know. Now you can go out and get these books yourself and do your own research and reach your own final judgment, as I say. You know, that's all I'm encouraging people to do. I'm giving them some advice and giving them some leads and let those leads take them where they may, you know.
Well, you know, we're in a society that, let's just you know, say it. We have supposedly a free speech society. Anybody can say anything they want to about anything. But, of course, you know that's not true now. You know?
Yeah.
But it sounds good. But I noticed at the beginning of your book, you have a picture of a big Nazi book burning.
Yeah.
And you, the headline is Bringing History into Accord with the Facts. And amazing, you first of all tell how many books were banned in Germany in the Third Reich. And you give the number of titles. Then you tell us how many books were destroyed by the winners of World War II, you know, that occupied Germany. And it is absolutely shocking, you know, the analogy there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Whole story in and of itself that someone should write a book about. But I cover it with one page and some pictures in the book. And basically, everybody's heard and seen the famous pictures of the Nazis burning books, you know. And in fact, they were Nazis burning books in Germany in the 1930s. But first of all, let me tell you this much. This is what makes it really interesting. Those book burnings were not directed by the Third Reich government. Everybody thinks that Hitler came into power and that Dr. Goebbels said, we're going to burn books and we're going to raid the libraries and the bookstores and the universities and, you know, we're going to get all these books that we don't like and burn them.
Right.
Well, no, what happened was those book burnings that we see pictures of, they did take place all over Germany on a number of occasions. But no bookstores were raided. No libraries were looted. It was not even directed by the government. The book burnings were conducted by university professors and by students, intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying, we don't like these particular books, and we're going to have a symbolic burning of them. So what they did was they got books that they didn't like, copies of the books, and burned them. In other words, if they didn't like a particular book, they'd go to a bookstore and buy a copy of it.
Yeah.
They didn't go into the libraries and take the books out of the libraries and take them out of bookstores. And, you know, see, that's the image that people have, you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and these people were Nazi sympathizers, don't get me wrong. And the German government issued praise for what these people were doing because they were saying, well, yeah, these are books that we just don't like. But this was not orchestrated by the government. Now, what's interesting further is that while there were books that were banned by the Third Reich government, that the actual number of books banned was 4,175 titles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these books were banned, but they weren't burned. They were actually preserved in government archives.
Yeah.
But in 1945, after the Americans and the democratic countries, quote-unquote, overran Germany, along with the Soviet Union, I might add, the American post-war occupation government, this is amazing. Okay, remember, 4,000, let's just round the figures for easy purposes. 4,000 titles were banned by the Third Reich over a 12-year period.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1945, the American post-war occupation government in Germany banned 4,000 by the Nazis, 35,000 titles banned by the Americans, plus every school textbooks now, that were used in Germany from 1933 to 1945. Now, the thing is, these books were, in fact, taken out of libraries. They were taken out of bookstores. They were taken out of publishing houses. That's what everybody thinks the Nazis did, but they didn't. But the Americans, they took untold thousands of tons of books and they pulped them. Now, this is the trick here. This is what's interesting. It's good to show you how the kind of propaganda we get from the mainstream media. The reason why the Americans, and how American these Americans were, is subject to dispute. But they deliberately did not burn the books because they didn't want people to say, oh, that's just exactly just like the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they pulped.
Pulped them. Mm-hmm.
Pulped thousands and thousands of titles, tons of books, 35,000, that's rounded upward, but 35,000 books plus every school textbook. And you know what's interesting? And I found this all out in just a little bit of research on the internet, because I knew there was some misinterpretation and misunderstanding about the quote unquote burning of books and who burned them and what really happened. But I found out that, you know, this Office of Information Control, which was run by the Americans, it was General Robert McClure was the chief of the office, of the division, but he actually had very little of anything to do with running it. And believe it or not, I was so shocked. I mean, I don't know why I continue to be shocked at anything, Tex. But it turns out the guy who was actually running all of this pulping of the books was William Paley. Now, this Paley was a high-ranking Freemason of long standing, and this is a Jewish guy, a Russian-born Jew, who was the founder of the CBS broadcasting empire. And helping him in this operation was Hollywood filmmaker Billy Wilder, a Jew born in what's now Poland. Now, you know, it's funny, if you start looking at further research on it, even including from Jewish sources, it turns out this whole OIC staff, the Office of Information Control, and isn't that interesting? That's what the title of it was, the Office of Information Control. Talk
information
about mind control.
Information Control, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they admit that the people on the staff, and this is a direct quote, were New Dealers, that is, followers of Franklin Roosevelt, intellectuals, emigres, Jews, and leftists.
Wow.
So these people were the real book burners.
Yeah, now
although they very nicely pulped them rather than burning them.
Yeah,
you know?
Paley was head of CBS.
Yeah, this is a guy, his family had established, you know, basically set CBS in motion. This is the guy who's the founder of the most liberal and pro-Zionist of all of the major networks, you know, and here's the guy who was over there, you know, here in the United States, you know, CBS talks about freedom of expression and freedom of speech and everything, but here the head of CBS was over there burning, or I should say pulping, 35,000 books in Germany.
Wow, 35,000 titles. That's
35,000 titles.
Considering
5,000 different titles, yeah.
That would be a huge number, even in the United States, but in Germany, that's just astonishing. So basically the Americans and the Allies, we got rid of thousands and thousands of books.
Yeah,
we were
the real book burners, yeah.
Wow.
Although as I use that term, we loosely, because I don't think somebody like William Paley represented any American
way. He did represent a certain faction, as we know.
A certain faction
yes.
of people operating
yes.
in America, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we're going to have to take a break now.
All right.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about AFP, for example.
Okay.
But let's also talk about the press in general. You mentioned Paley at CBS. What about the press really have been exposed recently? And we'll talk about the Bilderbergers, Matthias Chang. And if we have a moment, we'll talk about a guy named Michael Schur. I've seen him on TV a little bit, and you talk about some of his books.
Mm-hmm.
And even Super Mob by Gus Russo.
Yeah,
some interesting topics. Okay. Well, folks, today we have Michael Collins Piper with us. I'm Tex Mars. We've got a lot more to talk about. Ye Shall Know the Truth, this great book. All right. We'll be right back. The truth shall make you free, and ye shall know the truth. Well, Jesus said that in the Bible. And Michael Collins Piper has written a great book here. It has all kind of interesting asides that only somebody like Piper could reveal. Let's just put it that way. I mean, there's everything you'd want to know about Israel, the Jews, some of the shenanigans they pull. Of course, one of the books is Final Judgment, where he talks about the involvement of Israel, the CIA, and the Mafia, and others in the JFK assassination. Now, we want to offer this great book, Ye Shall Know the Truth, by Michael Collins Piper, to you. And we'll do so for just $20. Please add $5 shipping and handling, a total of $25. How to get the book? Well, you can go to Power of Prophecy online. That's powerofprophecy.com. Powerofprophecy.com. And you'll see the book. I think it's right there on the homepage, in fact. At the same time, if you get our newsletter, if you don't, you got to get our printed newsletter. We send out an issue every month. We have a bang-up issue coming out. Wow, it's going to be an interesting issue. Okay, here's how to get the newsletter. Just write us at Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733, and say, Tex, send me that newsletter. We'll be glad to do that. By the way, it's online. It's on powerofprophecy.com. You can get our newsletter and read the feature articles and things like that. You'll learn a little bit about my new book, Robot Alchemy. A lot of people have written me and say, what about robots? I don't understand. Is this science fiction or what? Well, you'll have to read the book, Robot Alchemy. And if you don't want to read the book, well, at least read the article about the book that I've got free for you on my website, powerofprophecy.com. Now, you can also phone us toll free and say, I want that book, Ye Shall Know the Truth. We've got plenty of copies and we'll get it right to you. Here's how you do that. Just call us, 1-800-234-9673. 1-800-234-9673. Now let's return to the regular program. Michael Collins Piper, the well-known author, is my guest today. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Tex. Hey, by the way, I just want to mention, you know, I got an email from someone today who had expressed an interest in my book, and you know, he says, I got your other books from Tex Mars, and I said, well, I said, I'll tell you what, you go to powerofprophecy.com or you listen to the show, and I'm going to be doing an interview with Tex about the book, and you can get the book right from Tex Mars. So I expect that guy will be listening to us sooner than later here, folks.
Well, good. I know people can get it from American Free Press, and American Free Press has a great bookstore, and they have many books that we don't have, so I don't mind at all giving them a plug here, American Free Press, the bookstore there. Get Michael Collins Piper's book. But we have a number of your books here.
Absolutely.
You know, and we don't let them go out of print. We keep them going, you know. So when people buy one, they usually like to go back and get another one because they know they'll find different things. Now, let's talk a little bit about the press itself. Now, you talk about who really controls the American press, Washington Post, New York Times, Fox News. You know, it recently came out that Fox News had one of their reporters report on a subject, and the writer said she just used the talking points, you know.
I mean, you know, really what it comes down to, Tex, I mean, you know, people will say, oh, it's an old canard that the Jews control the media.
Yeah.
Okay, now, you know, okay. Not every newspaper in America is controlled by Jews or by Jewish editors.
Mm-hmm.
But all the, you know, we don't have Newsweek magazine anymore, and U.S. News and World Report only comes out sporadically. But Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and now the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, you know, all the major newspapers, all the major magazines, the big weeklies, all of the major networks have been under the control of Jewish families and financial interests. You know, since practically from the beginning in the cases of all of them. But the bottom line of it is, it's not anti-Semitic to say that, although someone who is anti-Semitic may point that out. It's just a simple fact.
Sure.
But I find it interesting that the Jewish folks and people who are trying to curry favor with the Jewish folks actually try to tell us that it isn't true when it is true. It's like, you know, you look out and you see the blue sky and they tell you, well, it's really a very cloudy day out there. I'm sorry. You know, you look out and it's a blue sky. Well, it's a blue sky, just like it's a fact that Jewish families and financial interests control all these major newspapers. And even the Washington Post. Now, someone might quibble and say, well, the Graham family isn't Jewish. Well, no, the Grahams are the Graham heirs are half Jewish from their mother's side, but their father, their grandfather, was Eugene Meyer, one of the first governors of the Federal Reserve System, related to the Grand Rabbi of France, and a cousin of the Levi Strauss fortune, not to mention the first president of the World Bank.
Well, you couldn't get to,
that's pretty Jewish,
yeah,
and pretty established.
That's quite a
anyway,
Jewish pedigree, yeah. Well, the Newhouse people, now you cover them in some depth, and they have like, my goodness, newspaper after newspaper, magazine after magazine.
The power of the Newhouse family is different from the power of the Washington Post, because the Newhouse family, they have a lot of influence through their ownership of a lot of newspapers all over the country in medium-sized cities, medium to large-sized cities, like Cleveland, New Orleans, Harrisburg, you know, just to name a few that come immediately to mind. And their power is, and plus they also control the Sunday supplement called Parade, which appears, plus a whole host of other important magazines like Vanity Fair and The New Yorker, which, you know, have a lot of impact upon general discussion. But, you know, I want to tell you something. I want to point something out, Tex, about the Jewish control of the media and how it relates to the book industry. And this might fill in a few holes for some of your listeners, because I can imagine a lot of your listeners might be a little surprised that I would be endorsing books by mainstream authors coming from mainstream publishing houses. Mm-hmm. And they might automatically say, and I can see why they would say this, they might say, well, aren't these publishing houses Jewish?
Yeah.
And if these publishing houses are Jewish, why would they let this information get out there? Why don't they keep it secret? What are they doing? And people would naturally say, well, how can you trust this information? Well, I'm going to throw out some figures that will absolutely flabbergast probably most of your listeners, because, and I don't say that because your listeners or any people who read American Free Press aren't well informed, but fact is most people just don't have any idea about the actual figures involved in the publishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing. Some of these books that I've mentioned in my book, just, okay, let's backtrack. Anybody, any of your readers can go into any bookstore and go into the nonfiction section, whether it's a bookstore that sells new books, like, you know, Barnes & Noble, which is a national chain, or whether they go into an old secondhand bookstore. You go into that nonfiction section, or you go into your own local library and go to the nonfiction section. On the average, this is a shocker, when you consider how many libraries there are in the country, how many bookstores there are in the country, and how many people there are in this country who can actually read, the average nonfiction book doesn't sell any more than about 10,000 copies nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about that. That means then, you know, out of all the towns and cities in this country, your average nonfiction book doesn't sell more than about 10,000 copies.
Yeah.
Now, that's a staggering figure. Now, and people say, well, wait a minute, what about all these bestsellers? Well, there have been books that have been on the bestseller list of the New York Times that have never been bought by a single consumer. Now, what that means, see, this is the, here are these little intricacies of the publishing business, which is a Jewish business.
Oh, yeah.
That people don't understand. What happens when a book is on a New York Times bestseller list is that book distribution outlets have ordered a certain number of copies from the publisher. Mm-hmm. Now, they may only order as many as 40,000 copies, and that book can be on the New York Times bestseller list because they've been ordered by book publishers, mm-hmm. or from book publishers by book distributors, Barnes & Noble or small local bookstores or what have you, or and purchases from a few libraries. But the thing about it is, what happens then is those books are put in the bookstores, but those books can sit there and nobody will actually even buy them. Now, obviously, people do buy them. But that's why you'll notice if you go into some of the big bookstores, you will see books that were former quote-unquote bestsellers being sold for a couple dollars a copy. And the reason why they're being sold for a couple dollars a copy is because consumers didn't really buy them.
Mm-hmm.
The bookstores bought them from the publishers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And some, this includes some of the books that receive some of the biggest play in the mass media.
Oh, yeah.
People don't actually buy them. Now, here's another figure. Here's another figure, and I cite this in Ye Shall Know the Truth. Another secret about book publishing is that of the books that are sold, say there's a book that has sold 10,000 copies, a nonfiction book. It turns out, and these figures are from a few years ago, but, and this is from a Jewish author writing a book that was favorably describing Jewish people and Jewish success. His book is The Jewish Phenomenon, and the author was an American Jewish man named Stephen Silbiger. It turns out, according to the figures that he came across, between 50 and 75% of non-institutional hardcover sales in the United States are from Jewish people. In other words, of the books that are sold in the bookstores that aren't sold to libraries and so forth, 50 to 75% of the books that are purchased by Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of 1 to 5 books purchased during the year, the national average was 13%. That's the average American, but 39% of Jewish people bought 1 to 5 books. So basically what we're saying here is, according to Jewish sources, most of the books, 50 to 75% of the books that are sold in this country, are sold to Jewish people.
Sure.
And even those numbers of books sold are relatively small. Now, you hear about the famous authors like Stephen King and Danielle Steele. You know, their books sell in the millions and millions, okay?
Yeah.
And every once in a while you have a memoir by some famous person like Bill and Hillary Clinton or General Colin Powell. Those books actually do sell a lot of copies. But
uh-huh.
for the most part, the average book sold in this country, the average nonfiction book, 10,000 copies. If it did a little better, it might do 30, 40,000 copies.
Yeah.
Point is, there aren't that many people in this country who actually even really read books. So that's why they can put out books that have explosive material, because not that many people are going to see it.
They figure only the Jews will be reading these things.
And only the Jewish people will be reading it anyway, for the most part. I mean, you know, and again, these are not figures from the Nazis. These are figures coming from a Jewish writer talking about how wonderful it is that Jews have money and, as he puts it, can afford to buy books.
Well, you know, there's so many books that you get and so many movies that you see that have Jewish themes that are sort of built into them that the average Gentile, you know, doesn't even get it.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, there's the famous Christmas story, Jimmy Stewart. Let's see, what's the name of it?
Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life, exactly, Jimmy Stewart. But I was reading an article by a Jewish guy, and he was laughing at the idiocy of Gentiles. And he said, you know, we put all this stuff, because Hollywood is owned by Jews, for many, many years, for, you know, 50 years, we put this stuff in movies, and they don't even know it. He said, take It's a Wonderful Life. He said, you know, there are all these scenes in the house, and you look, and there's a Jewish mezuzah up on a stand.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and then you see, you know, you go up to the house, and there's something there on the door, and all these signs of Judaism. I know I was reading a little thing about Dennis the Menace, and they had a statue. This is a cartoon, of course. But they had a statue and a little candles around, a little statue of Buddha. So, you know, it was as if Dennis the Menace was your typical American little bad boy, you know, and his parents. But there was they obviously worshipped. It wasn't just for, you know, aesthetics looks, but they had candles and all this stuff set up. But you wouldn't really notice. It was sort of in the scene.
Exactly.
All these things, you know.
Things that are put out there, yeah.
Right. And so it is just astonishing. Now, I have taken a pen and paper, and, you know, I've gotten over the years very familiar with Jewish names. Of course, there are many names that, you know, Jews have grabbed onto that, you know, you don't know if it's a Jew or a Gentile. But just the Jewish names alone, you know, and I'll watch TV. I'll watch, let's say, Fox News, the old Riley Factor. And he'll have, let's say, during the whole show, he'll have 12 guests. And I, you know, I write their names down, and I figure this is just an average. 9 out of the 12 are Jews. You know, there'll be some guy from some think tank and some guy from this and some guy from some publication. It seems that about 85% or 90% of all the talking heads are all Jews. And I'm thinking, well, there's only 2.5% Jews in the whole United States. So they have to pick these guys. You know, they have to have a list, and only from the approved list can you have your guest.
You know, Tex, that's interesting because it recalls to mind two different things. Number one, years ago, I remember, and I have this clipping somewhere in my voluminous archives, and I think I referenced it in my book, Confessions of an Anti-Semite, which you, in fact, have made available through Power of Prophecy.
Mm-hmm, it is.
I think it's in that book. But anyway, I recall reading in the Washington Times 10, 15 years ago, where one evening on a weekend of a Jewish holiday, one of the big weekly broadcasting programs where they bring the columnists on to talk about some political issue, some major event had taken place, and it was on the Friday evening of a Jewish holiday, and they couldn't find anyone who was available because everybody they had tried to contact was Jewish.
Oh, I see.
That's a true story.
They need to title these shows, you know, Jews Discuss Politics.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they need to go ahead and tell us what it's all about. But it's,
you know, Tex, it's kind of funny. I recall having a conversation with somebody one time who's a small town journalist, you know, who wants to fancy, you know, herself as kind of a nice liberal and everything. And I mentioned to her something about the fact that someone was Jewish because it was relevant to the discussion. You know, in other words, you know, we were talking about something that it had to do with Jewish influence on political affairs.
Yes.
And she said to me in her most sincere voice, and she probably believed it, she said, "Well, why do you have to mention that they're Jewish?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well," I said, "you know, it's kind of funny." I said, "Every time I ever open up a Jewish newspaper, I always read these articles in Jewish newspapers about them talking about the fact that this author or this actor or this politician or this banker or this person or that person is Jewish." And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "okay, I said this, you know, I understand this is a Jewish community and they consider it relevant."
Oh, yes, they do.
I said, "But on the other hand," I said, "I will open up the Washington Post or the New York Times, which are supposed to be broad-ranging stories." And you know, my old colleague Vince Ryan and I had both detected this. You will read these long profiles of powerful people that appear in the style section of the Washington Post, whether it's an author or a politician or a think tank official. And usually about halfway down into the article, they will say, "Oh, he was the grandson of a rabbi."
Oh, yes.
Or, you know, I mean, now, and it's always invariably these kind of little hints. Sometimes they're subtle, sometimes they're just blatant. But the thing about it is that message is being telegraphed out there that's significant, that's important.
That's
but when
right.
someone like Tex Mars mentions it, or someone like Mike Piper mentions it, or some other person, you know, writing about it in the context of Jewish political influence and power and their impact upon our culture, that's when it becomes bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it becomes unacceptable, because you're only allowed to mention it if it's mentioned in a favorable way, or if it's mentioned in a subtle way that only the Jews can understand. And that's what it often is. I've told this story maybe even on the air with you before. I remember one time a friend of mine was tuned into and understood a lot of these things that you and I are talking about and that your listeners are tuned into. And we were watching a movie in a movie theater in a small town where in Pennsylvania, where there are very few Jewish people living in the community. And there were certain things in the movie that were Jewish. It was Jewish humor
uh-huh.
that you could only only understand if you happen to be Jewish, mm-hmm. or if you were someone who knew that it was Jewish humor aimed yes. at Jewish members of the audience. And the funny thing is, my friend and I were both amused by some of these things, and I remember either I turned to him or he turned to me, and we both commented that it was very Jewish, and we were sitting there in the theater laughing, the two of us,
mm-hmm.
whereas the rest of the people in the theater were turning around and looking back at us
uh-huh.
as though we were being disruptive and inappropriate for laughing about something because they didn't understand what they had heard on the screen mm-hmm. and why it was funny.
Yeah, well, you know, this is, I did a investigative audio tape about, 9 months ago called The Jewish Comedy Club. and I talked about you really couldn't get a career going unless you were Jewish, you know, and if you were Jewish, it's Katie bar the door, you know, and that's because from Milton Berle, on to today, you have all of these Jews.
Absolutely.
And it's the Jewish Comedy Club. I guess, you know, Las Vegas, owns them, but that's the way it is. Jimmy Kimmel, you know, every person, even Johnny Carson, who was not Jewish, but he constantly had all these Jewish guests on.
Yes, exactly.
And of course, that made him a big famous guy, you know, that he and Ed McMahon could have all these Jews on. And so it's just amazing. You know, Whoopi Goldberg might be the only one who's not Jewish, but she, you know, latched onto that name Goldberg, and I guess that gave her acceptability.
That was kind of I think that's kind of her own in-house joke, so to speak.
Yeah, maybe so, but.
Yeah, but I mean, but if it gets it, they get it out there, you know, and then it brings up, it just brings it before you, you know, and see, that's the whole thing, you know, it's, there's a lot of these subtle messages in the media
mm-hmm.
that are, even if people don't necessarily pick up on them, they telegraph an overall message, and it comes back to this use of the mass media to influence and to control us. You know, they tell us what to think, how to think, you know, what to drink, what not to drink. You know what I mean? Goes on
sure.
and on and on and on. And that's what the importance of independent newspapers like American Free Press and of broadcasts and publications like you have at Power of Prophecy, because until people can break through, talk about an iron curtain. This is the real iron curtain. This media, the way the media wraps us, you know, with this curtain around us, you know, and tries to keep us from knowing the truth. You know, see, that's the whole thing. So it's like there's a lot of ways to break through it. There's a lot of ways to understand what's going on, you know, and that's why we have to constantly keep our eyes open and be vigilant. There's no question about it.
Well, you know, Michael, I am absolutely amazed at my audience, at their perception on these things. I mean, even in a world in which we're saturated by Judaic images and thoughts, and the whole culture is taken up with Judaism, and people don't know that until they really begin to study it. Still, there's so many that are escaping it now, and it's becoming a veritable flood. I really think that Obama, you know, Barack Obama's president, he is so laced into the Jewish system. He's been trying to break free ever since the first year of his administration. He got rid of Rahm Emanuel. He got rid of, you know, his chief of staff. He got rid of many of the Jews that were controlling him. I don't particularly like Obama. He's, you know, liberal as can be, but he's trying to break free of them. Right now, it seems that the Jewish press, and I say that, I mean ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, et cetera, that's the Jewish press, is just bashing the guy because he would not go into Syria with big-time bombing.
You know, Tex, I just had this conversation with some folks here at American Free Press today. In fact, today I opened up the Washington Post, and again, the Washington Post is our liberal newspaper here in town. And the page 2 article by one of their key columnists is talking about Obama's scandals.
Yeah, oh,
you know,
listen.
And I said, here we go with the second term scandals. This is what the Jews have always done to keep presidents in line.
Oh, even, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, they're all suddenly coming out with exposés on Benghazi and the fact that of course, it seems that Obama is trying to strike back. He had the holder, the black man in charge of the Department of Justice wiretapping 20 reporters for the AP. Well, you and I know the AP is owned by the Jews.
You know what also is something else, too? And, you know, the thing is, this is so important to emphasize. You know, I get criticized. Over the years, I have pointed out some of these things about Obama, and people say, oh, there you are defending Obama. I'm mm-hmm. not defending Obama. You're not defending Obama. We're not advocating any liberal policies or anything
not at all.
We're just pointing out basic facts. And you know, I don't like the IRS more than anybody else does, but another thing that Obama did last year, the Obama administration's Justice Department opened up a grand jury investigation of Americans with secret bank accounts in Israel.
There you go.
Now,
there you go. Well, Madoff had the biggest bank account in the world,
and
they stole all that money, and it was in an Israeli bank.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so you know, these are the kind of things that, again, these things are really happening. My personal perspective on Obama is that, and I don't particularly like the guy. That's a funny thing. I keep reading about how I'm an admirer. I preferred Obama over Romney because I figured if Romney got in there, it would be all-out war overnight.
Oh, man, what a power.
Yeah, he has enough people around him. He's part of the establishment, but he's linked into some of those elements in the establishment, particularly in the military and in the intelligence community, who are fed up with foreign wars on behalf of Israel. And they're trying to hold back. Now, people turn around and say, oh, well, wait a minute. Obama just gave increased aid to Israel. And Obama did, yes, he's done a lot of things like that. Those things happen on a bureaucratic basis that sometimes it's beyond Congress, sometimes it's beyond the president in a certain sense. You know, these things just happen. They will happen. It's politically correct to do it. Not that I endorse it, but I mean, you know, but what happens is, and it's a constant game. I think it's
absolutely it is. I think he's fighting their control the best that he can, but he's got some, you know, some real
like Putin in Russia. This is what I
yes. Putin. I wish we had more
Putin,
time.
Putin may not be perfect, but I've said for years that what I perceive of Putin is that this is a guy who is playing a very big chess game, and not just a regular chess game, a multi-level chess game with three or four different players in the works, you know, and that's what he's been doing as far as dealing with Israel and dealing with the United States and dealing with all the problems of the Middle East. And, you know, people come back and, you know, they point, I've had different friends of mine and critics and friends alike say, when I've said something nice about Putin, they'll say, well, don't you know he's very good friends with a rabbi? And I say, well, yeah, I know that. Putin had a rabbi over to see him at the Kremlin, and he's very friendly to this rabbi and that rabbi, but that's what all politicians do. Politicians are friends with everybody.
Well, I tell you, I wish we had more time to talk. This is so, we just got into the good stuff here and we're already out of time. So, Michael, well, listen.
How it works.
I want to thank you so much for being on our program today to discuss your new book, You Shall Know the Truth. It's on our website. And folks, you just need to get this book by Michael Collins Piper. You're going to enjoy it. It is fireside reading, but it's important for fireside reading. Thanks again, Michael.
All right. Always appreciate it, Tex. God bless you and Wanda and all the good folks at Power Prophecy.
Well, give everybody at AFP our best. We thank the world of Willis Cardo and all the folks there.
Willis sends his regards, by the way. I told him I was going to be on the show, and he was all excited about it.
Well, that's good. That's great. God bless you, my friend.
All right. You take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. That was Michael Collins Piper. I'm Tex Mars, and I'm inviting you to tune in each week during this same time and discover the power of prophecy.